The future is a hefty responsibility and not one that we take lightly. But then taking things lightly has never been what Hefty is about. That's why we've created the Hefty Renew program that turns hard to recycle plastics into valuable resources like park benches and building materials. To participate, simply fill up an orange Hefty Renew bag with accepted items, tie it up, and drop it in with your regular recycling. That's it. It's that easy. It's time to rethink recycling with Renew. Particular valued resources may vary by geography. More info available at heftyrenew.com.
All right, in this episode, we are going to talk about OSHA. I know it's a dry topic, but hear me out. With all the news recently, when it was announced that OSHA may possibly be pushing out an emergency temporary standard, or ETS, that mandates companies that have more than 100 employees will be required to have those employees get the COVID vaccine or conduct weekly testing. You know, what's the process that OSHA has to go through to initiate that ETS? What is their policymaking process? You know, what, let's go over some this background about OSHA, because, you know, one, it's worth revisiting from time to time as safety professionals, but we're going to probably have to position ourselves a little better to answer some questions from those that are uninitiated as a result of, you know, OSHA, the latest acronym hitting mainstream media that, you know, the last one was PPE. You've heard me joke that, you know, we've got talking heads and politicians that couldn't spell PPE before now being experts at, you know, everything from masks to, you know, public health policy. So, we're going to get into OSHA. We're going to try to get ahead of the curve here because this is in our wheelhouse as safety professionals. Let's make sure that we're positioned to have good constructive conversations about the process by which OSHA follows to create new standards. Let's get into it in this episode. Before we get into today's topic, I want to remind everybody, if your business is reopening after any kind of closure due to COVID, or you've continued to remain open, but you're struggling with how to mark your facilities to ensure physical distancing and relay important information about safety and health as it relates to COVID, I want you to go visit our friends over at MightyLine Floor Tape. MightyLine has some great products for you to mark your floors, whether it be the stand here, the 6 feet distancing, or just floor tape to denote lanes of travel. They have everything you need to mark your facility. So hit the link in the show notes, visit our friends at MightyLine Floor Tape. They are incredible partners in safety. I can't thank them enough for their support of the podcast. Again, MightyLine Tape for all of your floor marking needs. All right, as promised, the Occupational Safety and Health Administration standards, you know, how do we get them? How are they created? How are they, you know, codified? How do they become law, the law of the land, if you will? So I am going to go over some particulars in that area, but, you know, look, it's going to get boring. I'm just giving you a heads up right now, but these are things we have to know. So let's go all the way back to Section 6 of the Occupational Safety and Health Act of 1970. That's the OSHA Act. This grants the Occupational Safety and Health Administration, or OSHA, that is a part of the Department of Labor, the authority to promulgate, modify, or revoke occupational safety and health standards that apply to private sector employers, the United States Postal Service, and the federal government as an employer. Okay, and there's some caveats here. We won't get into the minutia. We're going to keep this conversation in general terms so that we can have these conversations. We're better prepared to have these conversations with what I would say the uninitiated, those that are non-safety professionals, don't speak this language, don't know all this stuff. So we're going to keep it very high level, not get into some of these little footnotes that we normally would want to include. So we have that, remember, Section 6, but also our friend, our favorite, the General Duty Clause, right? Section 5A1 of the OSHA Act is basically what requires that all employers under the jurisdiction of OSHA provide workplaces free of recognized hazards that are causing or are likely to cause death or serious physical harm. So OSHA has the authority to enforce employer compliance with its standards and with this general duty clause through the issue of them issuing, I should say, abatement orders, citations, you know, civil monetary penalties, which we would all have a price tag on most of these citations, right? And that's the penalty part. The OSHA Act does not cover, and again, not getting into the caveats here, but in general does not cover state or local government agencies or units unless they have adopted or agreed to comply with those standards. And then, of course, we have state plans. There are states that have their own state-run safety and health plans, so it's not federal OSHA that would come in and do an inspection. It would be a state worker, basically. So, look, I don't want to get into that either in this episode, but I just want to make sure that it's worth noting if you are in a state-run plan, you would want to be able to have that conversation with employees or with others, friends, family members that are curious about this new ETS, about the vaccine mandate, and can they do this? Is this possible? So be prepared to have that conversation. Okay, so bottom line, certain entities that may be impacted by COVID-19, like state and local government hospitals, local fire department, and emergency medical services, state prisons, county jails, public schools, would not be covered by the OSHA Act or subject to OSHA regulation or enforcement. Again, very blanket statement. I get it. Don't get on your emails. Save them, okay? We're not covering all the minutiae here. I get it, okay? And I always say that because it's like every episode I do where I talk about, you know, this in particular, I talk about OSHA or rulemaking or something. It's a podcast. It's not a legal course. I make it very clear what I am talking about and not, oh my gosh, it never fails. Somebody sends me an email. You forgot to mention this. And it's like, no, I didn't. It's just it wasn't important to my conversations. So we're going to skip over state plans and all of that. And we're going to get into sort of the meat and potatoes, how OSHA promulgates standards. So OSHA may promulgate occupational safety and health standards on its own initiative or in response to petitions submitted to the agency by various government agencies, by the public, or even employer or employee groups like trade associations or even labor unions. OSHA is not required, however, to respond to a petition for a standard or to promulgate a standard in response to a petition. It's just that they may. There is no requirement that they do so. All right. OSHA may also consult with, you know, one of the two statutory standing advisory committees, the National Advisory Committee on Occupational Safety and Health, or NACOSH, or the Advisory Committee on Construction Safety and Health, the ACCSH. There are also a number of, an ad hoc advisory committee for assistance in developing a standard. So they can reach out and partner with those various committees when they're thinking about promulgating a standard. Also, there's a period of time that is baked into the rulemaking process, right, for the promulgation of standards. Pretty much it's governed under the provisions of the Administrative Procedure Act, or APA, and it's Section 6B of the OSHA Act that also applies here, okay? So those two right there, under the APA, informal rulemaking process, federal agencies, including OSHA, are required to provide a notice of proposed rules through the publication of a notice of proposed rulemaking in the Federal Register and to provide the public a period of time to comment on proposed rules. And again, I mentioned the OSHA Act. Section 7B actually mirrors the APA in that it requires notice and comment in the rulemaking process as well. So after publishing a proposed standard, the public must be given a period of time, and that's usually at a minimum 30 days to provide comments. In addition, any person may submit a written objection to a proposed standard or a comment, and then may even request a public hearing on the standard. So any member of the public, the general public, you, me, just Jane or Joe citizen, that's totally open, all right? You got to know where to find these proposed things. That's the trick, right? It's not like you've got the town crier on the corner as you, you know, walk to the market every morning to get the bread and milk going, hear ye, you know, be it known that on this day there's no, you've got to find where this stuff is posted. And that's the trick. Oh, man. So there's also something called a statement of reasons. Section 6E of the OSHA Act requires OSHA to publish in the Federal Register a statement of the reasons the agency is taking action whenever it promulgates a standard, conducts other rulemaking, or takes certain additional actions, including issuing an order, right? That's going to come up here later in the conversation, comprising on a penalty amount or settling an issued penalty. So there is a statement of reason. There's got to be a legitimate reason why we need this standard or temporary order. So in addition to the APA and the OSHA Act, there are other federal laws that apply to OSHA rulemaking, including Paperwork Reduction Act, Regulatory Flexibility Act, Congressional Review Act, Information Quality Act, and Small Business Regulatory Enforcement Fairness Act. And then President Clinton, in 1993, there was an executive order, 12866, that actually requires agencies to submit certain regulatory actions to the Office of Management and Budget and Office of Information and Regulatory Affairs for review before promulgation. So there are a bunch of hoops that have to be, you have to jump through, right? If you're OSHA and you want to just promulgate a standard, you just want to make a new standard. It isn't that they just decree something to be so, put it in the rule book, and then all of a sudden you're in. It's a lengthy process, okay? A lot of red tape. We're talking about a government agency here. So the rulemaking timeline, okay, it's important to talk about this one. The OSHA rulemaking for new standards has historically been a relatively time-consuming process. In 2012, at the request of Congress, the Government Accountability Office reviewed 59 significant OSHA standards promulgated between 1981, after the Paperwork Reduction Act and Regulatory Flexibility Act, and 2010. So for those standards, OSHA's average time between beginning formal consideration of the standard, either through, you know, publishing a request for information, or an advanced notice of a proposed rulemaking in the Federal Register, or even just placing the rulemaking on its semi-annual regulatory agenda, which is where we see a lot of this stuff, and promulgation of the standard was 93 months. So that's 7 years and 9 months, okay? That's the average time, okay? 7 years, 9 months. So once the notice of proposed rulemaking was published for those 59 standards, the average time until promulgation of the standard was 39 months, 3 years, 3 months. It's insane, right? The amount of time it takes. So that's why when the general public is like, why can't OSHA just say you have to do this? How come OSHA can't, you know, write a rule for this? That's why. Period. All right. Now, there are some things that can be done, and we're going to get to that. This is what we're talking about here. When the average member of the public or worker says, "What, you know," and I hear this a lot, and you're going to see this come up now more and more in the news stories, and journalists and talking heads are going to say things that are, you're going to just yell at your TV or radio or whatever and say, radio. Who listens to the radio? I do. I sometimes. But you know what? You get my point. You're going to hear some garbage come out of some folks' mouths, and you're going to go, they can't do that. That's not how it works. This is why we're talking about this. So we got to be prepared to have meaningful conversations with people. So I mentioned judicial review. Both the APA and the OSHA Act provide for judicial review of OSHA standards, right? So Section 7F provides that any person who is adversely affected by a standard may file, within 60 days of its promulgation, a petition challenging the standard with the U.S. Court of Appeals for the circuit in which the person lives or maintains his or her principal place of business. A petition for judicial review does not automatically stay the implementation or enforcement of the standard. However, the court may order such a stay, so it's really dependent on the individual. And that's why these emergency temporary standards will remain in effect or in place, even if it's being challenged legally, like, you know, and we're talking about the judicial review piece, right? So OSHA estimates that post-promulgation activities, including judicial reviews, can take between 4 and 12 months after the standard is promulgated. So keep that in mind when folks say, oh, they're going to issue this ETS and it's just going to get challenged in court. You think about, well, which court, which district, which judicial review is going to go first? And do you think that in that judge or the result of that review will be, look, because of the impact, we will issue a stay until we get more information and we suss this out? Or do you think it's more likely that they will say, well, you know, because of the potential impact of public health, you know, for COVID vaccines, by the way, is what I'm referring to, this ETS will remain in effect until we can suss this out, until such time we determine that it shouldn't go forward. I don't know. I think anymore, it just depends on which way the judges, you know, lean. And it's unfortunate that I think people look at that before they look at the law. So, and you know, you can chime in on that one if you want. It's just, it happens on both sides. So it's either one or the other. But that's an example of how you can get an ETS out of OSHA and it would still remain in effect, even if it's going through the judicial review period. And remember, anywhere from 4 to 12 months after the standard is promulgated. So, you know, we could be looking at an ETS for the next year if it gets dragged out. Okay. So speaking, you know, I've mentioned emergency temporary standards a couple of times, or ETS. Section 6C of the OSHA Act does provide the authority for OSHA to issue these emergency temporary standards, or ETSs, without having to go through the normal rulemaking process. OSHA may promulgate an ETS without supplying any notice or opportunity for public comment or public hearings. An ETS is immediately effective upon publication in the Federal Register, and upon promulgation of an ETS, OSHA is required to begin the full rulemaking process for a permanent standard, with the ETS serving as the proposed standard for this rulemaking. An ETS is valid until superseded by a permanent standard, which OSHA must promulgate within 6 months of publishing the ETS in the Federal Register. An ETS must include a statement of reasons for the action in the same manner as required for a permanent standard, so you still have to have a reason for it. State plans are required to adopt or adhere to ETSs, although the OSHA Act is not clear on how quickly a state plan must come into compliance with an ETS. So we've got some wiggle room there for state-run plans to delay sort of adopting some of these things, especially if there's proposed, you know, not just judicial review, but lawsuits. Many governors have already publicly announced that they are going to take this fight to court, right? So, I mean, just because OSHA can issue an ETS, that doesn't mean we're home free. That doesn't mean it's just going to be the law of the land. There are some potential hurdles that could come about that. Hey, look, a little bit about the ETS. So OSHA has issued 10 ETS, Emergency Temporary Standards, in its 50-year history. 10, okay? 4 of those were completely shut down by courts. Completely blocked, never even saw the light of day. And a 5th one was partially blocked. A lot of teeth removed from the 5th one. They have a 50% success rate. Okay, the last one was in June of 2021, right? It was the healthcare workers for COVID-19 that actually applied to healthcare workers. So before that one, the previous ETS was 38 years ago. So this is not something that happens very often. So the fear many have, not saying I have it or don't have it, but that I've heard, is that if politicians see that an ETS is a way to get around sort of the legal, you know, having to actually issue a federal standard or a law or a mandate, and they can use these other government bodies and their you know, the vehicles as a vehicle, I should say, to get what they want done without going through the legislative process. The what I've been hearing is their fear is ETS is going to be used a lot more in the next few years. It's worth noting. It's worth considering. So look, that's a little bit about the ETS, but there are some requirements. Okay, so Section 6C1 of the OSHA Act requires that both of the following determinations be made in order for OSHA to promulgate an ETS. One, employees are exposed to grave danger from exposure to substances or agents determined to be toxic or physically harmful or from new hazards, and two, that such emergency standards are necessary to protect employees from such danger. All right, so grave danger determination. The term grave danger, it is not defined in a statute or regulation. So that's one thing you got to consider. Grave danger is not defined. The legislative history demonstrates the intent of Congress that the ETS process, quote, not be utilized to circumvent the regular standard setting process, end quote. Okay, but the history is unclear as to how Congress intended the term grave danger to be defined. So there's the rub, right? And that's what I've been hearing and reading, is that because it's gray, there's wiggle room. And you know how in society today, we love to redefine everything based on what we're trying to achieve, not based on the actual terms, right? So grave danger, obviously we're talking about COVID. I'm not implying that COVID-19 doesn't pose a grave danger to individuals. I'm simply talking about how we can see, kind of blowing this out, you know, to a 30,000 foot view, how ETS can be used or potentially be seen to be used in the future. If we can kind of park something under this grave danger threshold, meet that threshold, right? So that's just something to consider. So one, you have to address a grave danger to employees. Then the ETS must also be necessary to protect employees from that danger. 75% of the population at the time of this recording, right around 75%, are vaccinated, either fully vaccinated or at least had their first shot. But you know, we're talking 75%. We're talking those that are the highest risk, 65 and over. There's like 92% vaccination in the U.S. Okay, and there are some pockets. That's average, you know, but that's across the U.S. Okay, so then we're talking about just workers. So many have used this argument, which to me sounds more reasoned than anything else. To me, just my opinion, not saying I agree or disagree, but if you're going to have an argument against the ETS, against mandating that companies with more than 100 workers get their employees vaccinated, require that they get vaccinated or do weekly testing, the necessity determination is probably your best bet to shut this down. As it stands today, is because, you know, how can you prove that? I mean, is this really needed right now? Is this a necessity? I mean, because there are outright, you know, there's an all-out effort to get people vaccinated. And, I don't know. That's where I think we're going to have a discussion or see some real data, stats, numbers as to, you know, is this a grave danger to young workers? To workers in their 30s, what is the fatality rate, the hospitalization rate, you know, all that good stuff. So I think that's probably where you would see a valid argument. You may not agree, you may agree or may not agree, but if you think about it, It has to be necessary to protect employees from that danger. We already have guidance. We already have the general duty clause. Now, it may not be specific enough, and you could think of terms in terms of ergonomic standard, by the way, when you get to this point. Why do we need like vaccines and weekly testing? We already have other mechanisms in place. Now, I mean, they may be weak. People may question them, but, you know, local health orders where the local authorities and states are better positioned to make decisions around what employers can do in their jurisdictions related to, you know, outbreaks, local outbreaks. They already have a interim guidance about, you know, when there's increased community spread and things like that. So an ETS may undo or run up against those other guidelines. And so I have heard others, and I don't know, I'm not an attorney, I'm not a lawyer, and I'm certainly not a judge. I have heard that many could bring that to a hearing to say, we already have guidance. We already have things that we can do that have been proven to protect employees. But again, you know, OSHA hadn't, that was the 1983 was the last ETS before this one for the healthcare industry. That's important. The other challenge with ETS is that it is in effect until it's superseded by a permanent standard promulgated under the normal rulemaking provisions, okay? And the OSHA Act requires OSHA to promulgate a permanent standard within 6 months of the ETS. So the ETS can only be in place for 6 months, and they have to promulgate a permanent version of it, you know, within 6 months. So are we saying that if you issue an ETS that requires employers of more than 100 employees, okay, screw the ones that are smaller, they can all get sick, okay? But if you have more than 100 employees, you have to make sure all your workers are vaccinated or conduct weekly COVID-19 tests. That ETS has to be replaced, right? According to the Act, a permanent standard has to be promulgated within 6 months. So are we saying now that from now until it's rescinded or removed into the future that we are going to permanently create an OSHA standard to require that specific vaccine? So what if the science changes? What if it's just becomes like the seasonal flu? So that's the question a lot of people have. Again, I'm just going through this whole process with OSHA. So this isn't about whether it's a good idea or a bad idea. I want us to be prepared to talk intelligently and accurately and correctly about what can and cannot happen when it comes to OSHA promulgating these things. All right. 6 months is well outside the historical and expected time frames for developing and promulgating a standard under the notice and comment provisions of the APA and the OSHA Act, you know, that I talked about earlier. Okay. Even under relevant federal laws and executive orders, there's just no way it's going to happen. So there's a dichotomy between the statutory mandate to promulgate a standard and the timelines that are involved, okay? And the ETS, it raises a question of whether or not OSHA could extend an ETS duration without going through the normal rulemaking process. Look, the statute and legislative history doesn't address that issue, that dichotomy, that difference between the two. Can OSHA just keep like extending an ETS? So I said earlier, in 10 times, the courts have fully vacated or stayed four of them. And they partially vacated one. So of the five that weren't challenged or that were fully or partially upheld, I should say, OSHA did issue a permanent standard either within 6 months required by the statute or within several months of the six-month period and always within 1 year of the promulgation of the ETS. Each of those cases, however, occurred before 1980 after which a combination of additional federal laws and court decisions added additional procedural requirements to the rulemaking process. OSHA did not attempt to extend the ETS's expiration dates in any of these cases. So I wish that we had more clear guidance on whether, you know, how we're going to get past that requirement. Chances are it's going to be a political remedy. Somebody's just going to say, I'm just going to issue a decree from on high that you don't have to follow that little piece of the law, that the ETS can remain into effect as long as there's a public health crisis. And then we get to define the public health crisis, or it's defined by number of cases or hospitalization case rate per 100,000 employees or something. There's got to be some sort of benchmark for this, okay? All right, so keep that in mind as we go forward, but the only thing we really have to go on is the last ETS. So if you look at the last ETS for healthcare employment, in its justification for a COVID-19 ETS, again, for healthcare employment, OSHA states that, quote, that healthcare employees face a grave danger from the new hazard of workplace exposures to SARS-CoV-2, except under a limited number of situations. Example, a fully vaccinated workforce in a break room. OSHA's determination that COVID-19 meets that grave danger standard required for an ETS rests on evidence and research on the following factors. Keep this in mind and how they kind of take these factors and apply it to every workplace in general. Okay, chances are they're going to just claim Delta variant blows all this out, right? It's a different animal now with Delta. One, the health consequences of COVID-19, including mortality and short-term and long-term health consequences from COVID-19, even in cases determined by the CDC to be mild. That was one determination. So now they're saying, I mean, how is that grave danger? It's mild, determined to be mild, but they added that. Two, the elevated risk of COVID-19 transmission in the workplace due to common elements of workplaces, such as shared workspaces. And the third one, the risk of COVID-19 transmission in healthcare settings where known or suspected infectious patients are receiving medical treatment. Now, the last one's going out the window when we talk about the regular workplace. So they have two things to go on. The health consequences of COVID-19, the mortality and short-term and long-term health. We don't know the long-term health consequences, so they're guessing. So if this gets challenged, and I don't know how the first one didn't or did, maybe it is, but even in cases determined by the CDC to be mild, they're saying that that's grave danger. That's the reason we need this. And the elevated risk of transmission in the workplace due to common elements of workplaces like shared workspaces. Okay, so those are the two things they have to go on historically. Because we can look back at that last ETS and say, okay, these are the three things they used. Now, the necessity determination, all right? Inadequacy of current standards and guidance is what they kind of went with. OSHA states that an ETS is necessary as it is the only means the agency has to control COVID-19 exposure in healthcare workplaces. The agency states that current OSHA standards, such as those covering respiratory protection, PPE, sanitation, HAZCOM, do not provide sufficient protection to healthcare employees exposed to known or suspected infectious persons. OSHA also states that its own guidance, and that provided by other agencies like the CDC, do not provide sufficient protections to employees. As such, guidance is voluntary and not enforceable. OSHA claims that there is a need for a uniform set of requirements for healthcare employers in all states, regardless of whether the state has adopted its own COVID-19 standards. Remember what I said earlier. They claim there's a need for a uniform set of requirements, one standard. Even if the state has adopted its own COVID-19 standards. So now we're talking about like where you could go in and challenge this and say, look, local municipalities and states, because there are hot spots and cold spots and warm zones, that, you know, it's not universal across the U.S. and it's somewhat seasonal, that we can look at the trends and we can look at the local efforts that are yielding results and say they're better positioned to manage this. This OSHA has stated in this last ETS that was not acceptable. We need a uniform set of standards. Okay. So they also assert, OSHA also asserted that the general duty clause provides inadequate protection to employees. The general duty clause does not contain specific requirements for employers. In addition, OSHA claims that there is a heavier burden of proof that the agency must meet for enforcement of the general duty clause versus enforcement of a standard or ETS. So they're saying that gives them a specific thing to enforce versus the vagary that is usually found around the general duty clause. Okay. So OSHA argued in the preamble to its ETS that the development, availability, and overall success of the COVID-19 vaccines in the United States, listen to this, do not obviate the need for an ETS, but rather serve as evidence of the need for an ETS. OSHA states that it has a statutory responsibility to protect all workers, including those who are unvaccinated, regardless of the reason for those workers' vaccine refusals. OSHA claims that the ETS encourages vaccination among healthcare workers, as many as 25% of whom may not be fully vaccinated, by exempting fully vaccinated workers from certain requirements in the ETS and by requiring that employers provide paid time off for employees to receive the vaccine, eliminating what the agency cites as a major barrier to vaccinations. In addition, OSHA asserts that the ETS will provide additional protections to non-vaccinated employees, including those who are unable to be vaccinated due to medical or other reasons, and those with compromised immune systems that may limit the effectiveness of the vaccine. And finally, OSHA states that while more evidence is needed to determine the overall effectiveness and duration of the effectiveness of the vaccines and the impact of new variants of COVID-19 on vaccine effectiveness, the ETS will continue to provide protections to workers regardless of vaccine status or efficacy. All right. I can see the language here, right? The groundwork, how you could pull out some statements, except for maybe that last one, right? Because the last ETS, it didn't mandate vaccines, you know, alone per se, and require weekly testing. It was a bunch of other stuff with PPE and respiratory protection, types of PPE and providing them and all that, where all that's talked about, as far as we know up to this point in the general workplace ETS proposal, is a requirement for vaccinations or weekly testing. Okay. I could see how they could craft this last ETS and blow it all out into the general workplace and use the new variant and an increased case rate. That the challenge to me is that when you look at last year and the case trends, the positivity case rates, and this year's, and they're only like 92% are impacting unvaccinated workers. I don't know. Again, I go back to what I said earlier when I'm wondering if somebody's going to propose that in a challenge to say, hey, look, we're effectively at 75% vaccinated rate in the U.S. This is a bit much. Do we need this? Or, you know, the 25%, they're in large part younger workers in the workforce, and it's hurting, you know, national productivity. It's hurting. It's sort of like the preamble to the Occupational Safety and Health Act. It is the findings of this Congress that the cost of workplace injuries, illnesses, and fatalities, the cost is too high. You know, it's the second paragraph where you get into, oh, yeah, yeah, and every working man and woman has a right to work. But it's just too expensive, you know? It's costing us. So that might be where we end up. So, look, I wanted to go over all of this because I thought it was really interesting. As I started seeing more and more articles written about ETS and what OSHA can do and all that good stuff, I thought I would go through a little history on OSHA and actually the rulemaking process itself. I hope you got a lot out of it. I mean, it's really meta, right? It's just as a lot of information in this episode, and I hope you took notes. I will post a link to a document that'll break all this down for you in the show notes. And we have been having an ongoing conversation about the Congressional Research Service spelling out all this information, but also on the impending TS, you know, what it might look like. We've been talking about this over at the Safety Pro Podcast community. So if you're not a member, consider going over there and joining and being a part of the conversation. It's a great group over there. I can't thank the community members enough for their support. And I look forward to carrying on this conversation. Look, we'll see what OSHA comes up with. Either way, it's going to be interesting. And because I'm just such a nerd, I'm so, you know, insanely curious about this stuff. I've been following it, and I'll continue to bring updates to the anything that breaks, any of the breaking news. I know I streamed that live when I got that, when it came across my phone, that alert that was announced. And we went live, did a live stream on the community site to announce that. But I'll continue to post over there on the community site any updates and updates to this episode as well. So let me know what you think. Head over to the Safety Pro Podcast community and drop in your comments. And I will talk to you on the next Safety Pro Podcast.